proceed with case number one, please. O'Sullivan versus the City of Chicago.
May it please the court. This appeal presents a matter of serious public concern for anybody residing in the City of Chicago. At issue is the city's unprecedented claim that the 1983 Shachtman Consent Decree is, as the city states at page 13 of its brief, quote, simply unenforceable, end of quote. As this court is well aware from past litigation, the 1983 decree has served for two decades as a bar to unconstitutional exercise of political patronage by the city in the hiring and promotion of its employees.
Does this case have anything to do with political patronage?
Yes.
And how is that?
It does so because what the structure of the decree is, Your Honor, is to say we're going to end political patronage in the City of Chicago in connection with the hiring and promotion. And the city will carry that out by adopting a plan of compliance. And the plan of compliance, in turn, incorporates detailed hiring provisions, all of which serve as a proxy for ensuring that there will be no political patronage exercise.
Your clients have a political patronage claim?
They do not as such.
That gets to the very point we're talking about. Why do they fit into then a class or a group of people that are able to use this decree?
Because a pivotal feature of the 83 decree is that the district court retains jurisdiction to enforce its provisions, not just on behalf of those who were plaintiffs in the case, but on behalf of, quote, any registered voter. And the complaints of the 13 appellant police lieutenants, two of whom are here in the courtroom, Lieutenants O'Sullivan and Aguinaga, fall squarely within the protective umbrella of the decree. Succinctly summarized, and I won't go into great detail, each lieutenant is a registered voter, all meet the requirements of promotion to captain, and they spell out in elaborate detail the multiple requirements of the 1983 decree, the plan of compliance, and the detailed hiring provisions that the city simply failed to live up to in connection with promotions to captain in 2000 and 2001.
So why did... go ahead, Judge, please.
Is there any voter in Chicago or Cook County who could not come within this decree?
Not that I know of.
So it covers everybody that is a registered voter?
That's correct.
So why didn't your clients bring a claim as disappointed promotion seekers? What's lacking in their claim?
I don't think there's anything lacking, Your Honor. And the reason that they didn't bring it is because they don't have to. What the city maintained below, and what Judge Darris said, as I understand it, is that the lieutenants had to go back as if there had never been a decree or plan of compliance and start afresh and re-prove the very case that the city agreed did not have to be proved up when it entered into the consent decree.
Could they show causality? Could they show that they were not promoted because of a lack of compliance with the decrees, with the decrees procedures?
Now you're getting, I think, Your Honor, into the case and the merits if it's sent back below. What they have alleged is that they were directly and adversely affected by the way in which the selection process was done, and without reciting it, the thing boils down to the fact that the then superintendent of police simply didn't follow the procedures that it was supposed to, which is to set out in advance what are going to be the hiring criteria, follow those criteria, publish those criteria, end up keeping a record of those criteria, and that was simply swept away by the superintendent, and he quite candidly decided in his own discretion who was going to be promoted to become a captain. And then
aren't there any oral exams involved?
Yeah, there's all kinds of requirements.
With the oral exams, did he say what he actually relied on?
As alleged in the complaint, and it's never been disputed, I don't believe, all he said was, I'm going to pick those people that conform to what I believe a police captain ought to be. Now, maybe he makes that on the right basis, but that's the very point that we don't know. He can make it on any basis he wants to.
Does he have any discretion?
Well, of course he's got discretion.
Can you prove that he did something wrong within the terms of the agreement? And secondly, can you gain standing by agreement?
Let me deal with the first one.
If this court were to hold that the lieutenants did possess standing, wouldn't we be ignoring the rule that you cannot confer jurisdiction by agreement?
No.
All right. Tell me why, please.
Okay. Let me deal with the last, because I think it really goes to the crux of what we're talking about.
Okay.
Originally, what the city's position before Judge Darrow was the problem is the standing of the police lieutenant. They've now abandoned that position. Even they don't maintain in their brief that the lieutenants have to prove that they were the subject of unconstitutional political patronage. What they now agree is, I believe, that all they need to show is that there was noncompliance with the plan of compliance with the decree and with the detailed hiring provisions. Now, what's now up before the court in the city's revised position is, no, the problem here is that the original Shackman plaintiffs don't have standing. And so what they want your honors to do is, 20 years after this decree became final, now say we're going to revisit whether or not the Shackman plaintiffs had standing. And if there was anything that was made clear by the 1928 decision of Justice Brandeis in the Swift consent decree case, is that's an issue that ends when no appeal is taken. You can't come in 20 years after a consent decree has signed and say, whoops, there was no jurisdiction at that time. That's simply not the law. And as we point out,
the underlying problem was somewhat different here, though, isn't it? I mean, there's no issue of mootness later or anything of that nature. The question is, was Shackman void ab initio? Nobody had standing to bring that suit. We never had people before the court with the requisite adverseness to really make that a lawsuit.
Let me address that, because, again, you're right on what I think is the key issue here now as the city has presented it. And I think it was decided exactly, both by Swift and more recently by this court, in the In Re Factor 8 case. And let me read what I think is some key language that this court articulated there. The principle that jurisdictional defects may be noticed at any time is limited, as we explained in In Re Edwards, by the equally important principle that litigation must have an end. After a case has become final by exhaustion of all appellate remedies, and that was certainly the case with regard to the Shackman decree, as far as the city was concerned, only an egregious want of jurisdiction will allow the judgment to be undone by someone who, having participated in the case, cannot complain that his rights were infringed.
Why isn't this egregious? The thing was never a case of controversy to begin with.
On the contrary, Your Honor, I disagree with Your Honor, and I know that Your Honor authored the Shackman 2 opinion. But go back to the time that the decree was entered. At that time, the governing law was Shackman 1, in which this court said, yes, the Shackman plaintiffs did have constitutional authority to proceed. Then Judge Bua, on the hiring aspect of the case on the merits below in 1979, reaffirmed that the Shackman plaintiffs had standing. That was the posture when the city then had a chance to appeal Judge Bua's decision. They filed an appeal, and they dismissed it. And they dismissed it because they decided, as a conscious decision, that they were going to enter into a consent decree. And that's what became the 1983 consent decree.
Is there any way, in your view, that the city of Chicago could now obtain the dissolution of that consent decree?
I pause, Your Honor, only because we're a little bit outside of what my authority is within the context of this case. Here's the reason. As we point out in our brief, the city actually has the current Shackman proceeding going before Judge Anderson.
Yes.
They have moved to vacate the 1983 before Judge Anderson. My own personal view, and it's not worth very much, is I don't think they've got any basis to vacate the 83 case before Judge Anderson. But they sure don't have any basis to come here in a collateral attack on the 83 decree and try to get Your Honors to vacate.
Why is there a difference between the two procedural contexts? Why is one more preferable than the other? I understand you think neither is meritorious, but why is one more more acceptable than the other?
Again, and I believe it was in Factor 8, this court said if there was any basis for an attack, you ought to do it in the district court by a Rule 60 motion, or you ought to proceed by a motion to modify the decree in accordance, back again to the old Swift case, this time by Justice Cardozo in 1932. That's the way to go. You don't come in a collateral proceeding and say, hey, Court of Appeals, throw out this decree which has been around for 20 years, complied with, and never challenged by the city. That's just not the procedural context. Now, as I say, in my view, I don't care whether they're before Judge Anderson or here, it's too little and too late.
Because here we not only have the precedent of Shackman 2 saying there was no standing to enter the decree, but we also have the Supreme Court's decision in Rutan, which pretty much makes this whole thing overtaken by events, or at least it should be, doesn't it?
Yes, and let me pick up on that. What I think is implicit in your question is, in effect, is Shackman 2 the law today, and ought that govern the current judgment as to whether the Shackman plaintiff...
Well, Shackman and Rutan together. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess I take some comfort from the recent decision by this court in earlier this year, and let me get the case that's right, Majors versus Ebel, I guess is the name of it. And there this court found standing by a candidate to sue based on the fact that his political supporters were being forced to disclose their identity by revealing that they'd given money. And this court said in that case, hey, you are entitled to rely on the First Amendment rights to protection and anonymity in your political contributions, even though you're the candidate and you have no First Amendment rights of your own in that regard. Now, what I think that says to me, Your Honor, is that some of the direct versus indirect distinctions on which Shackman 2 rested, I don't think are as vibrant and vital today as they may have been back when the Shackman 2 decision was decided. But I repeat, I don't think Your Honors has to get to whether or not that's the law. I frankly
Sir, do you see that your time is on?
I see that, and I apologize.
No, I, if you want to keep going, you won't have any rebuttal time.
Only because I've never heard what the city has to say in response to our brief. I'd like to hear what Mr. Rosenthal has to say, and I'll respond.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Coffey. May it please the court. This case is brought to enforce a 1983 consent decree in the Shachtman litigation that the plaintiffs believe forbids Chicago Superintendent of Police to promote lieutenants to the rank of captain based on his assessment of their record of performance. Our submission is simple. The district court lacked jurisdiction to enter the 1983 decree and therefore to enforce it today, because the plaintiffs who sought and obtained that decree lacked standing. There was no justiciable controversy before the district court when it entered that 1983 decree. Our submission this morning will be in two parts. First, we will explain why the plaintiffs lacked standing to seek or obtain the 1983 decree. Second, we will explain why that renders the decree unenforceable. With respect to the justiciability of the underlying Shachtman case, and I should make clear, this is the Shachtman case. It's captioned O'Sullivan. That's just an administrative convenience. In the 80s, Northern District of Illinois decided it couldn't have all the enforcement petitions brought before a single judge, because that would overwhelm them. So they got randomly assigned all the district judges. But this is a contempt petition to enforce the judgment in 69C-2145. This is the Shachtman case. With respect to the justiciability of the Shachtman case, which is what is really before this court on this contempt petition brought under the Shachtman decree, the plaintiffs in the underlying Shachtman case, suing exclusively as voters and candidates, allege that patronage hiring deprived them of their First Amendment right to fair election.
Aren't they also alleging standing, however, as disappointed promotion seekers? Is there any substantive difference between the allegations in this complaint and the allegations they would make if they were proceeding on that basis?
Well, Judge Ripple, there are two aspects to your question. First is, if they were suing, if they are suing, Shachtman plaintiffs sued only as voters and candidates. Now, Shachtman 2 says you can't challenge patronage hiring if you're suing as a voter or candidate. We see no principal distinction between patronage hiring and patronage promotion, but we don't have to speculate because in this court, en banc decision, in the Rutan case, the standing holding on which the en banc court was unanimous. I know, Judge Ripple, you didn't agree with everything in this court's opinion, and you got vindicated in the Supreme Court. But the court was unanimous on standing in Rutan, and it held plaintiffs suing as voters and candidates don't have standing to challenge political hiring or promotion. Now, the Shachtman case was brought only by plaintiffs suing as voters and candidates. The district judge ruled they didn't have standing to assert the rights of public employees. They never contested that ruling. They never amended their complaint to bring in any claims on behalf of public employees. So the first thing is that Shachtman case, because it was brought by voters and candidates, falls under the same reasoning as Shachtman 2. There's simply no clear enough relationship between patronage and the outcome of elections to create a justiciable controversy. Conversely, if they had brought their own Rutan claim, as Judge Darrow recognized, they would be required to allege something they are unwilling to allege, which is the reason that I was not promoted by the superintendent of police was my political affiliation. They've never made that allegation. They're just relying on the dizzying procedural requirements of the 83 decree, but they're not willing to make the allegation that would create a justiciable First Amendment claim on the part of an applicant for public employment or promotion, which is, it was politics that resulted in my inability to get the promotion. And that was exactly Judge Darrow's reasoning. To present a justiciable controversy, they have to allege their own First Amendment right not to be deprived of a promotion based on their political affiliation. And certainly nothing in this court's opinion in the Majors case overruled the decision in Chapman 2 or Rutan, or even more recently in Plotkin against Ryan. Majors is an entirely different situation. That's about the right to engage in political advertising free from government regulation in the midst of a political campaign. That's got a much greater nexus to the right to fair election.
What they're claiming is that the consent decree, just the only open was you had to be a vote registered voter.
That's right, and the consent decree for that reason creates standing that goes beyond Article 3, because this court has held registered voters don't have standing to complain about patronage. So Article 3 is a jurisdictional limitation on the authority of the federal courts. This court has held, most clearly in the Acropat case, but in a lot of cases, that there's no consent decree exception to Article 3. You can't, by consent, say federal courts have authority to hear cases that don't present justiciable controversy.
But we have said that you have had all your cracks at subject matter jurisdiction, then the direct time for direct appeal has run. It's all over. That is the ballgame. How do you distinguish those cases?
Well, let me start, Judge Ripple, by pointing out that there is one very basic proposition on which we rest on that point, which is the parties can't waive or consent to subject matter jurisdiction. It always has to be present. And the defect here, identified by Shackman II and its progeny, goes to subject matter jurisdiction. The requirement of a concrete injury in fact, fairly redressable by favorable judicial decision.
But that was true in cases where we've tolerated the continued existence of judgments even after, as long as the direct appeal is run. What's different about this case?
Well, and let me speak to that, because when Mr. Janus read you that quote from the blood products litigation, that quote talks about when a judgment has become final. There is nothing final about Shackman II. The blood products case was a case where a class
action. There's nothing final about Shackman, that's for sure.
That's right. Exactly the problem, Judge King, in our view. In that case, there had been a settlement of a class action. The judgment pursuant to the settlement had already been paid out. Case was over. There was nothing left to do. And then some dissenting class members come in and say, please overturn the settlement because there's a jurisdictional problem. And this court says, when the whole shooting match is over, the interest in finality is so strong that we will require only an egregious lack of jurisdiction.
So you're arguing that any time the court is exercising its equitable jurisdiction and the decree is under the continuing supervision of the court, it is subject to being reopened?
Exactly. Well, the interesting thing here is the finality argument cuts the other way. The only way to achieve finality in Shackman is to consider this jurisdictional issue. Now, their argument is basically that we entered the consent decree in reliance on what is, to be blunt, you know, an error by this court in Shackman 1. And in reliance on that error, we agreed to the consent decree. Their argument is that creates a species of federal jurisdiction that runs in perpetuity. Now, cases like the blood products case and the Edwards case, which also, that was a bankruptcy case, that they also cite. In that case, the property had already been sold, the money had been paid, the whole thing was over. There you need an egregious lack of jurisdiction. Now, we may well have an egregious lack of jurisdiction here, but the point is, these plaintiffs today are continuing to invoke the jurisdiction of the federal court. They filed this case seeking additional relief. They want something from the federal court.
In your view, how do we distinguish between an egregious lax of jurisdiction and just plain ordinary lax of jurisdiction?
Well, if that were relevant, now we say we don't even need to reach egregiousness because this case, the Shackman case, isn't final. And in a case that isn't final, the plaintiff, like any other plaintiff, bears the burden of establishing jurisdiction. But even if egregiousness, one pretty good test is, if the court in the very same case has ruled that the very same plaintiff lacks standing because controlling decisions of the United States Supreme Court have utterly repudiated the theory of standing. That's pretty egregious. But having said that, we don't even think that you need to reach egregious.
Is the subject matter of the underlying litigation at all important? In other words, in some cases this could be pretty much a private litigation. This is certainly not. It involves a public municipality. Does that enter into the finality issue at all? Our analysis of the finality issue?
Well, we agree. There's a line of cases in this circuit, most prominently including Evans versus the City of Chicago, which we cite in our brief, that say there's special federalism issues raised when a federal court is engaging in ongoing supervision of local government. There, you really ought to have an appropriate basis for federal court supervision.
Evans never had a majority, though, did it? It's hard to say what that case stands.
Well, that particular opinion, but subsequent opinions, Judge Ripple, you authored one in the Camiotti case. Judge Easterbrook offered two in the David B. litigation, which said that even though there was just a plurality opinion in Evans, the principle that there needs to be some substantial federal claim underlying a consent decree before it can be enforced is a sound one. And we think that the two David B. cases, as well as your own opinion in the Camiotti case, Judge Ripple, embrace at least that much of the plurality's opinion in Evans. Now here, the interest in finality that says when you've already paid out the judgment, when you've already sold the property, they'll come back to court and try to disrupt it. That's not present. What is present here is these plaintiffs are coming to federal court now seeking additional relief under a decree. They bear the burden of establishing jurisdiction. And that leads to the basic principle on which we rely. Let me quote from the Supreme Court's decision in the Sozna case, because it is our submission. While the parties may be permitted to waive non-jurisdictional defects, they may not, by stipulation, invoke the judicial power of the United States in litigation that does not present an actual case or controversy. And as this court has recognized, most clearly we think in the David B. litigation, as well as Camiotti, a consent decree that isn't supported by federal jurisdiction can no longer be enforced. In fact, that's pretty much the square holding of David B. That's why we say this case really ultimately is just like the Supreme Court's decision in the Kekkonen case. That was a case in which the underlying suit was within federal jurisdiction. In some ways, even a better case for enforcement than this one. But what happens is the parties agreed to a settlement agreement. The case was dismissed under that settlement agreement. And then later, there was an allegation by the plaintiff that the defendant had breached the settlement agreement and came to the district court for enforcement. And the Supreme Court held that even if the original case was within federal jurisdiction, a district court can't enforce a settlement agreement unless there is some independent basis for federal jurisdiction to bring that enforcement action. And Judge Ripple, that's why we think Kekkonen is the more applicable case here than cases where everything's over with, like the Edwards case or the Blood Factor litigation. In Kekkonen, the court said when the only thing you can point to support jurisdiction is that a settlement agreement got entered, there's no federal jurisdiction because there's no federal jurisdiction simply to enforce settlement agreements. In the Plotkin case, the court made this point even clearer in a footnote, in footnote 5, which we commended the court because we just love footnote 5 of the Plotkin case. Let me quote, "The Shachtman Decree cannot create standing in cases where the requirements of Article 3 are not satisfied." And I suppose that brings me back to the question of egregiousness, because if the court has to reach the question of whether the lack of jurisdiction is egregious, I suppose the clarity of that statement from Plotkin, which just restates the law in this circuit, makes the lack of jurisdiction here quite apparent. Mr. Jones cautions the court about the importance of combating patronage. That has nothing to do with this case. Nobody's contending that patronage is going to come back to Chicago if this court rules that the Shachtman plaintiffs presented no justiciable controversy to support the 1983 decree. Patronage isn't going to come back to Chicago first because the 1972 decree remains in place and that forbids the use of politics in hiring. It's not going to come back because the First Amendment itself, as construed in Rutan and other cases in that line, mean that if these plaintiffs really think they were denied promotions because of their political affiliation, they can bring a plain old civil rights case. And if they can prove that they were denied promotions because of their political affiliation, they will be entitled to relief. They, however,
practical matter is going to make it harder to enforce political free hiring principles, though, in the city of Chicago, right? It'll be tougher.
They will have exactly the same ability to enforce those principles that every other applicant for public employment in the country has. The 1983 decree, however, was entered in a non-justiciable controversy. The Swift case, that's the best they apparently can do, obviously has nothing to do with that. Swift was not about a case brought by lack of standing. The only claim before the court there was no case of controversy because the United States never presented any evidence to the court in support of its claim for liability before the consent decree was entered. We know from subsequent opinions, and the Comiati and David B. litigation are very good examples of that, that in order to enforce the consent decree must be based on an underlying justiciable controversy. Here there was none. We respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I'm astonished at the argument that was made. Repeatedly, Mr. Rosenthal said that there was no jurisdiction to enter the 83 decree. Yet in their brief, at page 28, they say, when the 1983 decree was entered, the Shackman hiring and promotional claims were within the court's jurisdiction under Shackman 1. That's what the facts are. And the simple fact is that the city then chose not to appeal. They chose to enter into a consent decree, and if consent decrees are to have any meaning, they've got to be final, and everybody knows they're final. People are going to jail for violating consent decrees. What we're really confronted with here is having failed to appeal, the city now wants to say, well, but other people won, Sheriff Elba. But that's exactly the decision that was made by this court in the Local 322 case that we cite and quote in our brief. And again, I don't mean to belabor this thing, but the language is clear. Put simply, Local 322 made an unwise choice. It opted not to join the UAW in seeking certiorari, and now attempts to circumvent the result of its tactical decision by riding on UAW's coattails. That the UAW won in the Supreme Court is of no moment to Local 322. Whether or not the UAW succeeded before the Supreme Court matters not here. Local 322 is entitled to one and only to one judgment. The city got that judgment in the 1983 decree.
Awesome.
That was it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank
your
you
time.
Very much. Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement and proceed to case number two, please.